Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing. How important are figs? Most people don't eat them, I'll tell you. Also, grape seed extract. It's doing something really good. And why you should avoid those items of low-fat cheese and milk. Also today, an extended edition of our public health comments. I'll be talking about the study that finds the average child is now chronically sick. First time in American history. And then where does all that money go and all those promises for over 45 years for war on cancer? Well, according to Colin Todd Hunter in Countercurrents, the cancer cash cycle. And also, how really good is the research that supports new drugs, miracle drugs? It isn't. Very flimsy. Lisa Garber will give us that insight. Then we're going to look at something that we should be paying more attention to. And that is, let's be honest about guns. Let's be honest about doctors. They both kill. The difference is, doctors kill 2,450% more Americans than all gun-related deaths combined. So why aren't we trying to do something to stop this? Mike Adams of Natural News will give us an insight and a report on that. And then Eve Smith, dying for satisfaction. Being happy with your doctor is bad for your health. Why is that? We'll talk about it. Also, dumbed-down population accepts outrageous vaccine logic from John Rappaport. And if time permits, well, they've got a new drug out. Pretty good for them. $1 million per patient. That's how much you got to cough up if you want to use their drug. How do they get away with it? Why isn't there some criticism of charging $1 million for a single drug? Well, because they control the system. Reuters, Ben Hirschler, will give us the insight on entering the age of the million-dollar medicine. Then, continuing with our series on fascism, Wim Banzi is going to talk about how fascism is coming in bits and pieces, almost so slow that the average person just doesn't pay attention to it. And that's the big problem. What happens when you stop paying attention to the little losses of freedom? We'll talk about that. But because this is our talkback hour, there won't be a guest, and there will be a lot of opportunity for you to call in and share your questions, your thoughts, and your points of view. Our number, 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Let's begin. I grow figs. Many people in this audience who have backyards grow figs. They've told me. They've actually brought them at lectures when I'm around the country. Or different fruit that they grow. Good for them. But there's a reason why we should do more with figs. Dried figs in India is called anjer, A-N-J-E-E-R, and they last a long time. And figs grow on trees, small trees. Some trees can get very large. They belong to the mulberry family. And dried figs are better concentrations of minerals and vitamins. Now, you can't eat a whole lot of them because they do have a natural sugar content, but they're loaded with good nutrition and really good fiber. It's a very soft fiber, and it helps relieve irritable bowel syndrome. That's according to the latest studies. Also, figs lower triglycerides. They're very rich in potassium, which helps regulate blood pressure and hypertension. And dried figs contain high levels of phenyl antioxidants, which help fight against the damage caused by free radicals. Also, calcium is pretty good in figs, and that strengthens our bones. And if you're suffering from an iron deficiency, figs are also good sources of building red blood cells, and that helps carry oxygen through the body. Now, the natural sugars in figs make them a good snack even for diabetics, as long as you don't overdo it. And the magnesium content in the fig is good for your cardiovascular health, especially people who may have AFib or afibrillation or a tachycardia or an irregular heartbeat. Also, cholesterol levels can be kept better in check because of pectin, and a soluble fiber, pectin, is found in figs. And figs are great for your skin. And they also contain the omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids that help prevent coronary heart disease. And in fact, in the Middle East, they've been used as an aphrodisiac and also in India. So just one of the reasons why something as simple as a fig and we don't pay attention to it. We should. You can also throw them in a blender and make them up into a smoothie. Another thing we should be using is grape seed extract. Why? Here's the latest from University of Colorado Cancer Center, Susan Patterson. Patients with colorectal cancer may benefit from the cancer growth inhibiting power of grape seed extract. In fact, the more aggressive the cancer cells are, the more effective the grape seed extract works at targeting and stopping the growth. And grape seed extract is amazing in that it attacks the cancer cells but leaves all the healthy cells untouched. And of course, chemotherapy can't do that. It kills all cells. And the power of grape seed extract seems really remarkable. In fact, there is a person there, Rajesh Agrawal, an investigator at the Cancer Center, and her team that were looking at the effects of chemotherapy and in stage four chemotherapy and also grape seed extract. And they had a lot of promise when they talked about grape seed extract. Quote, "We've known for quite a while that the bioactive compounds in grape seed extract selectively target many types of cancer cells. This study showed that many of the same mutations that allow colorectal cancer cells to metastasize and survive traditional therapies make them especially sensitive to treating with grape seed extract." So one more reason to have, I would say, between 100 to 200 milligrams a day in your diet. But then if you have cancer, then you could go up into 500 to 1,000 milligrams. Now, a lot of people historically believe that if they're eating a low-fat dairy, like cream cheese or cottage cheese or milk, it's better than the whole-fat milk. Lisa Garber of Natural Society wants to share some research that shows that's not the case. Now, mind you, a lot of dietitians recommend low-fat varieties of milk products. And they don't want the full fat, including cheese and dairy. And about half the fat in a full-fat dairy product is saturated, which until recently was the villain of many food myths. This so-called fat fallacy was promoted primarily in the 1950s by Ansel Keys, and has resulted in, according to a Consumer Reports survey, 51% of today's average American is either consuming or trying to consume less fat. But not all fats are equal. Anyone listening to this radio program knows that. You have good fats. I've said before, good fats for putting into our blender in the morning or using in salads or over casseroles or rice would be olive oil, extra virgin organic olive oil. Also very good would be avocado oil, again, first press organic unfiltered. Almond oil is excellent. Flaxseed oil is terrific. So these are really good oils. Now, the oils for cooking would be coconut oil and mustard seed oil, which is very good, and macadamia nut seed oil. Now, those should be the oils that you cook with because they can resist temperatures far better than any of the other oils. But that still doesn't mean that you should be deep frying or cooking at high temperature. You shouldn't. And so here's what they found. And I'll quote this. It says, raw and full-fat dairy benefits. Arguably the most healthy kind of dairy is the raw kind from grass-fed cows and goats and sheep that have not been pasteurized. Not only does pasteurization deactivate the enzymes in milk, but raw milk itself contains greater amounts of vitamin A, butterfat, omega-3 fats, healthy unoxidized cholesterol, and conjugated linoleic acids. Raw milk also can be enjoyed by lactose intolerant people and those who suffer from allergies, anemia, thyroid problems, chronic cough, cancer, and numerous other ailments. Pasteurized full-fat milk from grass-fed animals, however, are still healthier to consume for most of us than their further processed low- or non-fat varieties. Saturated fats are known to be antiviral. They contain caprylic acid. They're antifungal. They contain lauric acid, and they're anti-plaque. But the benefits of these fats don't end there. They help you lose weight, because fat helps slow down digestion. You consume more calories, but can no longer, without eating again, you can go much longer. And calories from hyper-frequent snacking that comes from eating extremely low-fat diets add up over time. Also, they encourage heart health. A 16-year study of Australian adults found that those who ate full-fat dairy were less likely to succumb to cardiovascular disease, and it may lower the risk of cancer. Subjects in a study who consumed at least 4 servings of high-fat dairy foods daily experienced a 41% lower risk of bowel cancer than those who ate less than 1. And they may help with diabetes. Palmitic acid protects against insulin resistance, and diabetics are going to be impacted. And they aid vitamin absorption. It doesn't matter how many vitamins you pop in pill form. If you're not consuming the fat, it needs to be absorbed in your body. The vitamins A, D, E, and K, in particular, call for fat in the diet. So that's one of the reasons that she and others advocate organic, whole milk products. Now, as a vegan, I don't consume any dairy products, but that's just my diet. But a lot of people do, and I'm suggesting that they go towards the whole food. On that, I would absolutely agree with her. If you're not allergic to it, and if it's a part of your diet, then don't buy the non-organic milk products, because you could get pesticides that are sprayed on the grain. They're grain-fed mainly. They're given stimulating hormones, and one of those stimulating hormones, which is a growth hormone that gets to produce more milk, is known to have carcinogenic activity. So one of the reasons I would suggest eating that way. Now, I remember growing up in West Virginia, and when I was out in the country and milking the cows early in the morning, we'd put them in these big tins. I'd sit in the back of the truck, and we would take them down to the bottom part of Parkersburg, and this was maybe 10 minutes away from downtown. And there was an old, like, general store, and it was not a large area, maybe 3 blocks total, 3 blocks down and 3 blocks across, 6 square blocks, were these old buildings. Well, I'm talking about Civil War era buildings. And one of them, people would take their milk, and that's where it would be distributed to a dairy. And it was always never pasteurized. So then they would take it and they'd bottle it. And in the morning, you'd go out and there'd be bottles of milk on your porch, and the cream would be up at the top. And you'd have like 2 inches of cream. And that was healthy. And it was also very tasty. Today, everything is overprocessed, and especially milk. Now, for those of you who eat almonds, you're doing the right thing. Remember the sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce? He said, almonds prevent cancer. Later turned out, when the actual science of almonds was done, he was right. There are anti-cancer properties in almonds. Well, almonds are an outstanding nut. They're a very good source of the monounsaturated, heart-healthy fats. In fact, we believe that it protects the heart. One study from Harvard's Nurses Health Study indicated that women who eat at least 5 ounces of nuts each week see the risk of heart disease drop by 35%. Another study, this one from Harvard School of Public Health, found in 4,000 people that eating nuts at least twice a week could reduce your risk of having a second heart attack by 25%. Now, how is this possible? What's actually occurring here? Well, we know that the almonds, for example, are loaded with antioxidants. That protects from oxidative stress. They're a very good source of the omega-3 fatty acids. That can prevent dangerous heart rhythms and heart attacks. They're rich in fiber, and that helps lower cholesterol. They have plant sterols within them, then that can help lower the bad cholesterol. They contain vitamin E that can prevent the formation of plaque on the artery walls. And they also have L-arginine, an amino acid that can increase artery health, making them less prone to clots. So all the good reasons why you should have almonds. There's one study here, and it says, the results of this study suggest that unblanched almonds, whether dry, roasted, or in roasted nut butter form, play an effective role in cholesterol-lowering plant-based diets. So that's good. Now, let's just say that you have some memory issues. And I have recently, and this is one of those strange things that happen occasionally in my life, I'm out on the road, I'm filming, and then I get a call that there's an emergency, there's an intervention, a family had to go and get one of their children because he's 62 years old, but he's in a rough spot right now. And part of the reason he's in a rough spot because he has no short-term memory, and it came on really fast. And he's had all the neurological tests and MRIs. This is simply a matter of all of the bad choices catching up. And it does in all of us. And in women in particular, catches up a little faster, generally in your late 30s and early 40s. You start to see it in the form of thinning of the skin, brittleness in the nails, more common infections, vaginal infections, and bladder infections. You start seeing a loss of muscle strength, tensile strength. Also, skin becomes less elastic. Hair becomes a little thinner. You see more hair after you get out of the shower. Now, it's normal to lose anywhere from 50 to 100 hairs with each shower. And we have anywhere, depending upon if we're a blonde or brunette or black-haired, we could have anywhere from 100 to 125,000 hairs on our head. So losing some hairs doesn't really, cause a lot of problems. But we're seeing, once people go into perimenopause, larger amounts of hair coming out. It can be due to other things as well, including the use of birth control pills and medications, very common for medications, alcohol use, it's common, tranquilizers. In any case, then you start to see the short-term memory go. And it's really hard for a lot of people to get a handle on this because their long-term memory is just terrific. They could sit and talk with you for hours about things that happened decades ago. But ask them what happened this morning, and therein is the problem. I've seen people who will give you the same identical statement 5 or 10 times within an hour. And the problem is because they don't have short-term memory, they can't remember that they just told you something. And if you ask them to do things, even things that are necessary, and you come back and they haven't done them, it's because they've forgotten. So you have to write everything out, and they really should be supervised. And that's what this family is doing, and I've given them a protocol, and they're following it. And I check in with them on a daily basis just to make sure that it's going forward. And the father said, who's in his 80s, late 80s, he said, how long is this supposed to take? Because my wife's suffering from Alzheimer's, and this is a real chore. I said, look, it could take realistically about 2 to 3 years, if he's really diligent, in order to see a return of the short-term memory. You have to rebuild dendrites. You have to detoxify the body. You have to break down naturally the amyloid plaque and get it out of the brain. This doesn't happen overnight. And I gave the protocol. Now, the good news is that there's some new approaches that are showing a lot of promise, and one of those comes from Ayurvedic medicine. I'll share this with you. This is from Case Adams from Green Med Info, and the title of his article is Ayurvedic Herbs Improve Memory, Cognition, and Alzheimer's. Now, because we have so many people suffering from memory loss and Alzheimer's, and an epidemic of people are going to be having brain problems, 97 million people over 47, and it's only going to increase. So thousands and thousands a day are reaching the age of 60. So we've got a big problem ahead of us, and no one is addressing it, and that's unfortunate. So here's the latest. And this, by the way, is based upon the traditional Indian healing called Ayurvedic, A-Y-U-R-V-I-D-I-C. And they use a lot of herbs. They found that the Medical College of Thailand's Konkin University conducted a double-blind, placebo-controlled and randomized clinical trial with a large group of elderly adult volunteers with an average of 63 years of age. And the researchers gave the adults either a placebo or an Ayurvedic herb medicine called Brahmi, B-R-A-H-M-I. Now, the botanical name is Bacopa, B-A-C-O-P-A, Moneri, M-O-N-N-I-E-R-I. And so they received the Brahmi every day for 3 months, or a placebo, a sugar pill. Now, before and after the treatment period, the researchers tested the subject's memory accuracy and attention span and cognitive processing speed and reaction time. And they also measured their brain cell monominergic functions, and which, by the way, relates to their neuron firing speeds. And the subjects were also tested every 4 weeks during the treatment as well, and to see how well they were holding up. And the end result was the herbal medicine treated group were given 300 milligrams or 500 milligrams of a whole herb extract, and the group given the Brahmi had significant improvement in cognitive function, including increased memory, greater attention spans, and better reaction times. So that's very good. Now, most people have never been to an Ayurvedic specialist. It takes a little more time, which is good because the doctor really spends time with you, quality time, because it's not just about herbs, it's about food and what foods you eat and whether they're hot or cold foods. Not as far as their temperature, but the energy they create in the body and how much you eat and what you should drink. And it's a whole lifestyle process, and it has a long history to it. So yeah, the researchers also found that the group taking the Bacopa altered their chloroneric and monoaminoic activity. And they concluded, quote, this suggests that Bacopa, Monmeri, can improve attention, cognitive processing, working memory. And it went on to explain how. Now, another recent placebo-controlled clinical study on Brahmi was conducted by psychopharmacology researchers at Australia's Swinburne University of Technology. They gave a group of healthy adults a placebo or standardized extracts of the Brahmi, and the study utilized dosages between 320 and 640 milligrams, and it was also a crossover design. That means, in lay language, that the adults given the placebo were tested and then given a washout period of several weeks, and then given the herbal medicine, and those given the Brahmi were then given a washout period where they were given nothing for 2 weeks, then given the placebo. Well, the clinical research showed that there was substantial improvement in cognition and memory during the actual use of the herb, but not with a placebo. And then there was a clinical study done at Portland's National College of Natural Medicine, also a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. And they were average age of 73, and they took 300 milligrams of the Brammy or a placebo for 3 months. And what they found was that the Brammy-treated group, quote, had greater recall, less anxiety, decreased average heart rate, and cognitive increases. They stated, quote, the study provides further evidence that B. Moneri has potential for safely enhancing cognitive performance in aging. And then they actually had some work done here at two other universities, including Pharmacy College of Thailand's Narsuyan University. And they found that it helped get rid of the beta amyloid induced damage of Alzheimer's disease among brain cells. So that's good. So good news for those suffering from memory loss and cognition problems and Alzheimer's, the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and then we're going to our public health section. Now, normally I would only report one story, but today I'm going to report several. But I'm also going to be interspersing that with your calls. Our number on our talkback segment is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. From New Jersey. Hi, Paul. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
You had spoke about a study this week regarding EGCG and its effects on chronic fatigue syndrome. I forgot whether you said it reversed it or it lowered chronic fatigue syndrome. And the study was done on mice. And I didn't get any quantity as far as what humans should take. I believe you said the mice were fed 50 milligrams.
Yeah. And on a human level, for an average adult male or adult female, anywhere from 250 to 1,000 milligrams non-caffeinated green tea, EGCG. Okay?
Does that reverse it?
It improves it.
Okay. And also, would L-theanine have any effect on chronic fatigue, since it is out of green tea?
No. Theanine helps to relax the body and take away our biochemical reaction to a lot of the distress. That's why it's good in the evening to take to help you sleep better.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All the best, Paul. We'll take more calls, 888-874-4888. And now to some of our public health issues affecting everyone in the audience. This is from Heidi Stevenson from Gaia Health. It says, study finds that the average child is now chronically sick. By the way, I'm going to be doing a full hour on my progressive commentary show on Obamacare. you see the mistake that has been made with this is that the corporate Democrats or the corporate liberals have said, well, this is very important because it helps protect people who are not insured, and then you can't be rejected. Well, indeed, there are aspects that if you took them in isolation may seem like this justifies the entire bill. On the other side, the Republicans just want to throw everything away because they're so tied in to the ideology of the free market. The trouble is the free market only has one interest, earning a profit, enhancing the shareholder value and the executive compensation package. So how it makes its money becomes irrelevant. So here's what we should be asking instead. Why are we so sick? Why do we spend more money per individual and family and as a nation on health than any three nations in the world combined? Now, mind you, we spend more on health care than all of China and Russia and India combined. We're going to spend $3 trillion this year. It's increasing at about 12% per year. So the numbers now just keep going up. We'll be at $5 trillion a year in the very near future. So are we healthier? No, we're not. We've never been this sick. So how in the world can we say that we have a health care system when we don't? And that's a matter of fact. That's not in dispute. But just to let you know how sick we are, and especially the children in America, let me quote this here. It says, this is from Heidi Stevenson. Many of us have known, simply because of observation, that children are no longer healthy. Now a scientific study documents what we're seeing. The average child is now sick, chronically ill. It doesn't bode well for the future of the United States. The nature of illness now isn't sort of the sort of thing that once brought temporary discontinuation of play for a minor childhood disease. Now the illnesses plaguing children are ones that will be dodging them for the rest of their lives, making their lives both poorer and shorter. This is the gift that modern medicine has brought us, and this is the tissue on which it needs to be judged. Now, the big question is, why hasn't this been headline news? Wouldn't people want to know? But the fact is that the study isn't new. It was published 2 years ago. Everything about it is clearly intended to hide the truth. The study's title is A National and State Profile of Leading Health Problems and Healthcare Quality for U.S. Children. Key insurance disparities and across-state variations. And this gives the impression that the issue is primarily insurance variances. The study's conclusion doesn't mention this disastrous news, but the charts do. And here are some of the figures in the chart. Obese and overweight children, 43%. Risk of developing developmental delay, 32%. Environmental allergies, 23%. Learning disabilities, 12.6%, asthma, 12%, ADD, ADHD, almost 10%, chronic ear infections, 8%, behavioral and conduct problems, such as ODD, 7%, migraine headaches, 7%, speech problems, then developmental delays, food and allergies, anxiety problems, depression, bone, joint, and muscle problems, hearing problems, vision problems, autism problems, diabetes. And yet, there isn't a single word about the epidemic of ill health in children. Yet, that's precisely what the study clearly documents. It most assuredly does show the disastrous state of America's children's health. And overall, the study reports that 43% of children suffer from at least one of 20 conditions when obesity and developmental delays are not included. That's 32 million children whose health is damaged. Now, exactly how would Obamacare and our current medical system help these? It doesn't at all. That's why I'm going to do a whole program on the disaster of Obamacare, the for-profit insurance companies, the medical paradigm, the pharmaceutical industry control over all of it, the abuse by the FDA, the failure to do anything meaningful, the Surgeon General, the U.S. Public Health Service, they're all interconnected. They're all working together. They're all making money. But we're not getting healthier. So I'm going to take on these issues. So that's just one thing that we're not paying attention to, how sick the children are in the United States. And again, I will go into that in great depth, because the children's diet is an abomination. What's advertised on television for children, especially on Saturday morning programs that most adults don't watch, they plant a kid in front of a television. The kid sees ad after ad after ad for junk food and candies and artificially sweetened, colored, and preserved foods and high fructose corn syrup. And teenagers love those high fructose corn syrup, you know, fizz drinks. And then they start eating the hamburgers, the super burgers. And by the time they get into college, we're out of college. Now they're way beyond all that. They want a super burger. They want a super-sized pizza. They want everything being more. Well, none of it's healthy. None of it. It all produces disease. Every single item that the American public is eating, based upon current advertising, promotes disease. It's filled with genetically modified ingredients, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, antibiotics. The amount of protein is generally 2 to 3 times more than what the body can handle, which leads to kidney and liver problems. The calories are far in excess of what the body can normally burn out through normal metabolism. As a result, obesity is endemic. And then they give vaccines, which is a complete fraud. So on top, and then the medicines don't work, actually make you worse. So where exactly are we doing anything right? And the answer is emergency medicine, we do right. Everything else, we do wrong. That means most of the dietitians are dead wrong. They're killing people. And yet, they have not taken the step to open up their minds, as many dietitians have, to become more educated. So a whole program just on that, on the fraud of Obamacare. And shame on the left. It's supposed to have a brain, but of course they don't. They have a lot of hubris and arrogance, but they're not willing to debate the issue and look at the facts. Let me just give you one fact before I go to the cancer cash cycle from Colin Todhunter. From Mike Adams, I'll quote, "Doctors kill 2,450% more Americans than all gun-related deaths combined. Everybody agrees that the Sandy Hook shooting was a tragedy. Lots of people subsequently exploited the deaths of those children to push a political agenda of disarming Americans by claiming guns kill people. But compared to what? Swimming pools kill people. Horseback riding kills people. And yes, even childbirth kills people. Does that mean that we should criminalize getting pregnant? To make any sense of death statistics, we have to ask, compared to what? Because if we compare deaths by firearms to other causes of death, the picture is very, very different from the doomsday fear-mongering scenario CNN and other gun control pushers have whipped up into a national frenzy. In fact, as the following infographic shows, doctors kill 2,450% more Americans than all gun-related deaths combined. Your doctor is far more likely to kill you than an armed criminal. It's true. You're 64 times more likely to be killed by your doctor than by someone else wielding a gun. That's because 19,766 of the total 31,940 gun deaths in the United States for last year were suicides. So the actual number of deaths from other people shooting you is 12,174. Doctors comparatively killed 783,936 people each year, which is 64 times higher than 12,174. Doctors shoot you not with bullets, but with vaccines, chemotherapy, and pharmaceuticals, all of which turn out to be far more deadly than guns. This is especially amazing given that there are just under 700,000 doctors in America, while there are roughly 80 million gun owners in America. Now, how do 700,000 doctors manage to kill 783,936 people each year? That's over one death per doctor, while 80 million gun owners kill only 31,940, because owning a gun is orders of magnitude safer than practicing medicine. You are over three times more likely to be killed by a drug side effect than a firearm. On the firearm side of things, you're almost twice as likely to be killed by yourself than by someone else using a gun. But even this number can't be blamed on guns themselves, because if people really want to commit suicide, they'll find other ways to accomplish it, like jumping off buildings or bridges or slitting their throat or their wrist or taking a lot of pills and beer. Where's the call for doctor control? Listen again, especially those on you on the left who've never seen a drug that the FDA creates that promises something that you're not promoting. So where is the control of doctors? Have you asked for such control? Not in this lifetime have you asked. Despite the statistical fact that you're overall 24.5 times more likely to be killed by your doctor than by a gun. And it's actually far worse if you spend more time around doctors than you do around gang members. There's absolutely no call for the media for doctor control. There's zero talk about making medicine safer, and there's zero talk about the number of people who are medicated every day in America. There's no mention of all the people dying in nursing homes who aren't even given enough food or water or given as many as 15 different medications, and then they die. But hold on. When was the last time we asked for an investigation, where we asked for accountability, where we asked for anything changed, where we asked some control over this warehousing of human beings in old people's gulags, where they're just medicated to death or neglected to death? But one thing is certain, when you go in, you don't come out. Oh, I forgot, there was no asking for control. That shows some compassion, doesn't it? No, it doesn't. There's no mention of the astonishing fact that the surgical procedures do not need to be proven safe and effective before being tried on patients. Surgery in America is, in effect, a grand experiment, often conducted with little or no scientific support. There's no discussion of the fact that psychiatric drugs promote violent shootings, as we've seen over and over again across America. Nope. The entire focus is on how bad guns are, while the government simultaneously promotes how good vaccines are, and chemotherapy is good, and surgery is good, and pharmaceuticals are good, and everything else that's killing us in mass is good. No criticisms at all. Every U.S. hospital is another Sandy Hook. How about a little reality smack in the face for all of us to wake up, because we've been in a coma. Hundreds of people are killed every single day across U.S. hospitals from pharmaceutical side effects alone. On top of that, hospitals are killing people with superbug infections, fouled up surgeries, failed heart stents, and even infections you get in the hospitals. Bed sores killed 80,000. How in the heck does anybody die of a bed sore? Because it takes time for bed sores to manifest and then to become infected. Then you get amputation or sepsis and you die. And yet, tens of thousands die. So where's the discussion for this big problem killing tens of thousands of people? I forgot. There is none, nor will there ever be any. See, we can't criticize medicine or pharmaceutical drugs or greed or doctors, hubris, stupidity, arrogance. We can't do any of that because they control everything. And if you're outside, you can't do anything but shout inside. And they're so far away from you, the policymakers, their lobbyists, the foundations, the think tanks, the talking heads, the little pimps that they own on television that will say anything they want them to say. So are they going to get the message? Not in this lifetime. Because all those deaths overseen by doctors and pharmacists are making billions of dollars for the corrupt, criminally run pharmaceutical industry and the for-profit, corporate-driven healthcare complex. Obamacare, a death machine. And while Sandy Hook was mass murder and a tragedy, the U.S. healthcare system is practically a holocaust. In fact, the U.S. healthcare system has killed more people than, well, let's just do the math. In the last 10 years, if we had an average of, let's say, go on the low side, 500,000. That's 5 million. 5 million people died because of bad medicine or procedures or side effects or mistakes. Would you call that genocide? Medical genocide? I think it works. And that is because they have the right to protection. You can't fight them because they have the FDA, and they have Congress. They have the laws all on their side. Your thoughts? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And just one more thing from Eve Smith, NakedCapitalism.com. Quote, there is an important study in the Archives of Internal Medicine last month, which escalates an ongoing row as to whether patient satisfaction is in any way correlated with positive medical outcomes. The answer is yes, and the correlation is negative. Let's deal with healthcare case first. The study in question was large, 52,000 patients for 7 years. The summary comes from the emergency physician blog. Results of the study showed, by the way, listen very carefully to this, that patients who had the highest satisfaction rating spent more on healthcare and prescription medications than patients who had the lowest satisfaction ratings. In addition, the most satisfied patients had a 26% greater risk of death compared to the least satisfied patients. When patients in poor health were excluded, the risk of death from highly satisfied patients increased to 44% more than their least satisfied counterparts. And considered, drug research shows a fairly significant placebo effect. So one would assume that satisfied patients would show positive results merely from placebo effect. The fact that overall results are decidedly negative doesn't merely say that more treatment and more testing are ineffective. It says they actually do harm. So that, published in a peer-reviewed journal, very important. Let's say hello to Wiley from the Lower East Side. Hi, Wiley.
Hey, Gary. It's Willie Hernandez from the Lower East Side. How are you today?
Good.
You have a question. In 2010, you went through a 40-day juice fast, and you spoke about you saw many positive results, especially, I think, change of your eye colors. Can you share what other results you saw? And one more question. Are you going to have to walk the running walking club again this year?
Yes, I am.
Good.
Yeah, I am. I don't recommend anyone doing an extended fast as I did unless you are completely supervised. And you have to know why you're doing it and doing it for specific reasons. And then it can really benefit you. But otherwise, if you do an unsupervised fast and you have any underlying medical conditions, they could be exacerbated. I suggest people start with a one-day juice fast each week on a day that they're most likely to be resting. Start the day with, let's say, like a wheatgrass juice or your green juices, and it can be in any combination. Then later in the day, you can have like a citrus juice, grapefruit as your main juice, but then some lemon and lime in it also. Then later in the day, you can have a watermelon lemon juice, then finish off with green apple, grape, and cabbage. And then insert 3 protein shakes in there, where you'd have your protein from a non-genetically engineered organic rice, hemp, soy, and then your essential fatty acids. Now, that is relaxing the digestive system, allowing the juices to get in there and flood the body with enzymes, phytonutrients, and healing oxygen, all of which are good. So when I did my fast, I was doing it because I had reached the maximum expenditure of my chi, the essential life force. It was like hitting a wall. I had done a maximum of races, 52 races in I think, about 14 months, including seven marathons. I had done very well in those. I settled some world records, national records, regional, won all of them. And in fact, that was the year I was the Metropolitan Athletic Congress's Outstanding Master Track and Field Athlete of the Year. And then the next year won their indoor Grand Prix Series, and then the next year won it again. And I was nominated for about 16 years. But I, at the same time, was doing research at the Institute of Applied Biology overnight. I was counseling people all day. I was doing my radio shows. I was writing books, working on the ranch. Whole lot of stuff going on, long days. And one day, the chi simply wasn't there. And I could feel it. I could feel the energy. So I then, during that period of time, I also stopped doing everything except my radio show, and I did quiet meditation in nature alone. And I fasted in ways that I maintained my nutrient intake, but no solid food. And yeah, I lost some weight, and but that was to be expected. But then when I broke the fast gradually and came back, my chi had returned. But it was an important moment because it shows that when you push yourself too hard, you're imbalancing yourself, even in good causes, even for worthy things. So that's why now the message is, rather than do too much and achieve too much, simply each day keep your balance. Spend time in intellectual growth, creative growth, physical growth, spiritual growth. Have time for friends, family. Have time to spend in nature. That's far more important than getting a whole lot done and then imbalancing yourself in the process. So it should be combined, juicing and meditation. So if you were to juice on a Sunday, also spend quality time in nature. Go to a museum. Go to botanical gardens. Relax yourself. So it has to be a combination of the two. Greater clarity, greater insight, heightened awareness of your senses, more sensitive to the environment you're in and to people. That's what happens when you're disciplined enough to do the fasting. Does that help you?
Yeah, one more question regarding the same thing, juicing. In the beginning of your show, you talked about Alzheimer's. Now, under the guidance of a doctor, a patient who has Alzheimer's, in a short term, but in long term, in conjunction with nutrition, diet, lifestyle, were they able to, break apart the aggregated amyloid plaque
yes.
in the brain?
Yes, we've done that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that's good then. All right, thank you.
Okay, all the best to you.
Thank you, Gary.
One last call from Rudy from Montreal. Hi, Rudy.
Bravo, Dr. Null. I'd like to ask you, it bothers me that I've had circumcision, tonsils out, appendix out, wisdom teeth out. And I'm sure that a lot of it's not necessary, and allopathic medicine doesn't have they have a very superficial understanding of some of the functions like the tonsils and the appendix. The Chinese have a far more profound understanding of these.
I would agree with that. We've taken out way too many tonsils and adenoids in our medical system.
But what I would like to ask is whether it's possible to
regenerate.
Regenerate.
No, none of those organs are reversible. The only organ that actually can be rejuvenated to a degree, about 60%, is the liver. So that's why working to detoxify the liver is the very first thing to be done when you're helping people with disease, because the liver has to eliminate the toxins and also metabolize nutrients. It does two things simultaneously, conjugates nutrients, getting them out. So the liver is crucial, and that's why when people have chemotherapy, they don't realize how toxic chemotherapy is to the liver, to glutathione levels, and but fortunately, with a really good regenerative diet, you can rebuild the liver, and that's good news. We're out of time. Thanks a lot for your call, Rudy, up in Montreal. And looking at the clock, we're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Mm-hmm.